This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Catherine Fritke, and these are the stories you don't want to miss. For the week of February 27th, here are some top stories. Plaintiffs and defendants in the Melendrez racial profiling case met for a status conference in federal court this week. As KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins reports, the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office updated the court on its attempts to come into compliance with the judge's orders.
Addressing Judge Murray Snow, Sheriff Paul Pinzone said the most sobering moment of his first days in office was reading his name on the court docket, Melendrez and the United States versus Paul Pinzone. Pinzone inherited the case from his predecessor, former Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who is being tried for criminal contempt for disobeying Snow's orders. Judge Snow heard what steps are being taken by the new sheriff's administration to come into compliance. Andre Segura is a staff attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union, a plaintiff in the case. He says they're working with the department on a holistic review of deputy performance to combat continued racial profiling.
So if there is something that is causing their implicit bias, then we need to identify that and come up with some concrete constructive steps so that it doesn't turn into an actual problem.
Snow said he would work with the new administration under a presumption of good faith as long as the sheriff continues to demonstrate compliance with his orders. Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Flagstaff is divided over legislation voters passed in November to raise the minimum wage. Two ballot measures passed, one to increase the state's minimum wage and one to raise Flagstaff's minimum wage even higher. It's creating tension between friends and neighbors in town, and people are boycotting certain businesses. Workers say they can't survive without a higher wage, while business owners say their businesses won't survive. From the Fronteras desk in Flagstaff, KJZZ's Laurel Morales reports.
Joe Jager keeps coming back to Flagstaff.
I tried a bigger city and I tried even a smaller town, and we've just got a mountain right there and a lake over there and a creek over there. It's just got everything that you could want if you were a fan of the environment. But yeah, the cost of living has always been really difficult here.
Jager is an assistant manager and barista at Fire Creek Coffee Company.
It's the wage gap between what we're paying downtown rent or around Flagstaff rent and what we're getting paid has always been a lot bigger than other cities.
In fact, it's one of the largest gaps in the country. Workers in Flagstaff earn on average $19 an hour while paying more than $1,200 a month in rent. Many work two or three jobs and have roommates to stay in Flagstaff. In November, Arizona voted to increase the state minimum wage from $8.05 an hour to $10. It will gradually go up to $12 by 2020. Flagstaff voters hiked it to $15. It also made it so the minimum wage in Flagstaff is always $2 higher than the state minimum.
We have rich tourists that come for our mountain and they come for the Grand Canyon. The money's coming. We just need to roll with it.
But many business owners, especially smaller businesses with lower profit margins, are having a tough time rolling with it. Jamie Thousand owns Satchmo's and Route 66 restaurants. He was already paying above minimum wage before the legislation passed, but he says he's still trying to figure out how to raise his wages this high without hurting the customer.
We're all a little nervous. And looking at a 50% increase on base pay is a pretty daunting piece. You know, as we say in the restaurant world, there's an old rule of thumb that's a 30-30-30 rule, and 30% of that is labor. When you increase that base so dramatically, it does change the way you do business.
Thousand has had to cut two of his part-timers. A couple restaurants have shut down, saying the minimum wage increase put them over the edge.
I'm afraid that the community doesn't understand the number of price increases. It's not just going to be when you go to restaurants. We're seeing it across the board. We're already seeing it ourselves, our wholesalers as well.
Thousand says it's groceries and retail too. He says those retailers are competing with online stores. They can't raise their prices. Thousand and others tried to ask voters to reconsider the wage hike in a special election. Ronald Gunderson is an economics professor at Northern Arizona University. He says this isn't a self-fulfilling prophecy for employees.
The workers may be made worse off. They'll find themselves working fewer hours, and even though they have a higher pay, the money won't go as far if it's going to cost them more to eat out, to buy food, to buy clothing.
Gunderson says it's unfair to make business owners take on this burden. Instead, he suggests redistributing income through unemployment, welfare, veteran, and student benefits.
Some businesses and some nonprofits may simply just disappear altogether, and then the services that they provide just won't be here.
Nonprofits like the Hojoni Foundation, which provides care for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Monica Attridge is the CEO of Hojoni.
We're just playing a waiting game right now.
Attridge has asked the state legislature to help them with their budget. They're waiting to hear how much the state is willing to provide. She employs 150 people in Flagstaff and Prescott. It will cost more than $1 million to increase staff wages.
Worst case scenario, if we were to get no funding for next year, we would be out of business shortly after July 1st, as would the other eight providers of these services in Flagstaff. These clients cannot live on their own. So this could be truly devastating if the legislature doesn't come through with funding.
The Flagstaff City Council will vote next week on whether to extend the timeline, giving employers more time to come up with the increased wages. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
You're listening to the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Now let's go in depth with KJZZ's The Show in a conversation with the show's Steve Goldstein and Maricopa County Sheriff Paul Penzone.
Taking office in January, Maricopa County Sheriff Paul Penzone laid out a long list of priorities. One of those was to restore confidence among communities of color that they could trust the agency. That trust had eroded under his predecessor, Joe Arpaio. But Penzone's recent policy shift on immigration holds for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, has led to some confusion. And Sheriff Penzone is with me to talk about that. Sheriff, explain the recent policy shift between MCSO and ICE.
First and foremost, the county attorney has a responsibility to oversee all legal aspects related to the sheriff's office. And his team was in review regarding a pending lawsuit, doing some legal review, and they identified that there was a pattern across the nation of lawsuits for actions consistent with what we were doing here, which was holding detainees beyond the time when the courts deemed that they were to be released on what we call a consent hold for ICE. They found it to be an unconstitutional practice, and he advised me and my team of that, and his recommendation was that we cease and desist immediately because we were not only violating the Constitution, but assuming some legal implications that were going to be costly to our taxpayers. So it was a balance of what is the law, and therefore what we have to abide by, then how can we find a solution to overcome this to ensure that we are focused on public safety.
And then you modified that, at least based on what we have read and what we've heard. How much of a modification is it? Was it a step back to what the original policy was? Was it somewhere of a middle ground?
No, I greatly appreciate this question because I think there's some confusion. So we changed the policy as we were required to do so to be law-abiding. And then we spent the next few days trying to work with ICE to identify a change in the process, which are two completely different things. The policy was changed and we cannot apply these consent holds anymore. It's unlawful. And then we determined, is there a way for us to overcome the legality aspect of it and still facilitate the needs on behalf of ICE, which was change the process. So we're not holding anyone beyond what the court orders. But what we're doing now is allowing ICE the opportunity through notifications by my office when we're about to release someone to come into the jail and take custody of them immediately and then remove them from the jail as immediate so that hold on our behalf does not exceed legal limitations applied by the courts.
How important is the relationship between MCSO and ICE? The policies are such that they're a little confusing, first of all, and then there's also the feeling that immigration is a federal responsibility.
And it is. We need to understand what our lanes are and stay true to our missions. You know, our mission is serving this community with the state laws, handling detention on behalf of other law enforcement agencies. I authored a letter that I sent to Secretary Kelly at DHS in D.C. saying, hey, we want to facilitate and be helpful to our law enforcement partners, whether they be federal or state. But we're challenged by some aspects where the law is not seamless and your expectations of us creates a burden on our behalf because we're acting in a way that is unconstitutional and assuming a lot of liabilities that relates to lawsuits. We need a solution. So the relationship is critical, no different than working with our other partners at the local level. But we cannot break the law or go outside of our jurisdiction in order to accommodate their needs. We have to find a common ground.
One of the important things that you talked about a lot was bringing the relationship with all sorts of communities in the Valley, communities of color included, that had felt disenfranchised by your predecessor. In any way, does the expression by some groups that they're confused, they're not sure where you stand as it relates to some of this, do you feel like you need to work with those communities even more so they understand this?
No, that relationship has to be ongoing. And there's no doubt in my mind that this dynamic has created somewhat of a setback because there is confusion. But we all have to recognize that there's many cultures within our community, and when they are victims of crime, they have to feel confident to come forward. If they are witnesses to crime, they have to recognize that they're also protected if they come forward with information to help us catch criminals and solve crimes. And we have to provide public safety for everyone. And then we have to make sure that everyone is abiding by the laws, whether it be state or federal. So there's a lot of complexities to this issue. And my concern is we've been kicking this can down the road for far too long, and it's time for us to sit down and have a very responsible, professional conversation about identifying solutions and getting on the same page, because we cannot be at odds with our community, nor can we be at odds with other law enforcement agencies.
Is this a situation where it's a setback that's long enough where it's going to be another sort of hill to climb? Or do you feel like if everyone's at the table, you can be upfront, you can be honest, and the discussions continue?
We have to be at the table. We cannot choose a side and hold our ground because we're not serving anyone's best interest. So 2 months into it, I'll tell you, we've taken on a lot, and there are a lot of things to address. And I'm happy with how my staff has responded, because what they're embracing is the idea of, hey, we have to be ethical, professional. We have to understand that the rules apply to us no different than anyone else. And they're working exceptionally hard to keep that level of service at its highest point while still addressing these complexities. You know, this was not easy, but I'll tell you, I'm proud of my organization, and I'm proud of the hierarchy who said, hey, we have to make a definitive decision on this because we cannot be unconstitutional.
Maricopa County Sheriff Paul Penzone. Sheriff, thanks. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. You have a great day.
In business news, customers of the state's largest utility, Arizona Public Service, will not see as big a change to their electricity bills as they thought. KJZZ's Will Stone reports a settlement reached this week rolls back what the utility had been asking for in its rate case.
APS got a lot of blowback from consumer advocates and the solar industry over its rate case, most notably demand charges, a fee based on the 1 hour of the month during peak when you use the most power. APS had wanted to move most of its residential customers onto that rate, but has now ditched the effort. The agreement also means the average customer will only see about a $6 a month increase rather than $11. Stephanie Layden is with APS.
A settlement is a negotiation and a compromise between all parties, and ultimately the result of that compromise is very beneficial for the customers.
The settlement also provides some certainty for rooftop solar. It lets existing customers stay at their current rates. New ones will be reimbursed for the excess power they produce, starting at about 13 cents per kilowatt hour.
It's not ideal, but it's workable.
That's Alex McDonough with Sunrun.
We firmly believe that APS was at the table negotiating with us because they recognize that their customers were demanding access to solar.
Arizona regulators still need to sign off. A separate confidential agreement stipulates that none of the stakeholders will try to undermine or advocate against the settlement. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Astronomers voted on a definition of a planet in 2006, and Pluto didn't make the cut. Now some scientists are suggesting a simpler and much more inclusive definition. From the Arizona Science Desk, Melissa Siveny reports for KJZZ.
The proposed definition is planets are round objects in space smaller than stars. That would include not only Pluto, but also Earth's moon, Titan, Europa, and some asteroids. Will Grundy of Flagstaff's Lowell Observatory is one of the authors of the proposal.
In total, we count up a little over 100 objects that would probably qualify, and there's probably more to be discovered.
Astronomer Gerard Van Bell says the new language is a good idea. He says the definition voted on in 2006 focuses too much on a planet's interactions with other objects, and it leaves out exoplanets that orbit other stars. The revised definition solves those problems.
This is one of those things that makes it into a fairly simple thing to describe, and it makes sense to a four-year-old. And if the definition doesn't make sense to somebody at that age, then maybe it's a little too complicated.
The idea will be presented at a planetary science conference this month. It's meant to generate discussion among scientists and will not set in motion a formal vote. I'm Melissa Siveny in Flagstaff.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Made possible in part by Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Arizona Community Foundation, the ASU Biodesign Institute, Alliance Bank of Arizona, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Catherine Fritke, and this is KJZZ, your news and information source.